Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Curtis Institute of Music President Gary Grafman, who retires this year, and incoming President Roberto Diaz. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Wilma Theatre as they mount a festival of Carol Churchill plays. The celebration will include two full productions and readings of five of her plays. As the Kimmel Centre unveils new works of art, Susan Lewis explores Philadelphia's history of promoting public art from classical sculptures to clothespins. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit historic Falsington. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
On May 31st, Gary Grafman retires as president of the Curtis Institute of Music after 20 years in charge. His successor is Roberto Diaz, who'll be stepping down as principal violist with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Grafman has had an almost 70-year-long relationship with the Curtis Institute. He began studying piano under Isabel Vengerova at age 7. He graduated 10 years later, then enjoyed a more than 30-year-long career as a recitalist and soloist with the world's great orchestras and in recordings for Columbia and RCA. In 1979, an injury to his right hand curtailed his career somewhat. 1 year later, he joined the Curtis Piano Faculty, became director in 1986, and was named president of the Institute in 1995. His achievements as president include an overall improvement in academic standards, he's maintained the school's tradition of high artistic achievement, expanded student performances, and raised the organization's public profile. A concert tomorrow evening at the Kimmel Center will see the start of a series of events honoring Gary Grafman. The Curtis Symphony Orchestra will perform a program that includes Stravinsky's Firebird Suite, Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, and Ravel's Concerto for Piano, Left Hand, and Orchestra, with Grafman as piano soloist. The concert will be conducted by Philadelphia Orchestra Music Director Christoph Eschenbach.
I know Gary since many years, and of course I'm a great admirer of his pianism, but I'm a great admirer also how he led the Curtis Institute the last 20 years. And he's a marvelous person, great human being, utterly intelligent, and, well, I mean, these were golden years, but I must say at the same time that I'm very happy about the choice of Roberto Diaz as his successor. And I know Roberto, of course, also since years and years, and I know that he will be a great, great president for this organization, which is one of the greatest in the world.
I recently met up with Gary Grafman and Roberto Diaz at the Curtis Institute. I first asked Gary Grafman what he'd hoped for in his successor once he'd made the decision to retire.
My main concern, actually, it was a concern, was that my successor would be a musician, a great musician, because there was talk of perhaps looking in a different direction, as the case with so many other schools, of having an administrator who may like music as well, but basically an administrator fundraiser type. So I was delighted, I was ecstatic when it turned out the way that it did.
And when Roberto Diaz's name came up, what was your reaction?
Well, I knew him, of course. Not only, I mean, he was in the faculty, but before he was in the faculty, I knew who he was and heard him play. So, I mean, I was, as I say, absolutely delighted about this.
And Roberto, what are your thoughts on the immediate future when you officially take up your role as president?
Well, the first thing I have to say is I'm going to quote Gary, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think that what goes on here is really incredible. I mean, there really is nothing like it. And I think that we certainly are able to say that because we spend time in other music schools as much as we do. Every time I travel somewhere to play concerts, I end up doing master classes. So I'm fairly well aware of how most of the other big music schools are set up. To answer your question, are there some things that we can do in the future? You know, perhaps I think that one of the things that I would like to think about a little bit is the fact that sometimes it's surprising to me how some people have not heard of Curtis. I just had an experience not so long ago in Europe where the managing director of a very well-known orchestra in Europe didn't really know too much about Curtis. And I think that considering the impact that this school has had in musical life, that's a little surprising to me. And I think that if we can help make the school a little bit more visible in some ways, then we can certainly do that. And just make it so that it's not that everybody needs to know about Curtis, but really there are some people that perhaps don't know about what's going on here or how great what's going on here is that can be made a little bit more aware of that. And
even within the city, it has to be said that when people talk about the city of Philadelphia, they say Philadelphia Orchestra, Art Museum, Barnes, and perhaps Curtis should be in that same sentence.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, certainly, it's funny, and I don't mean to say anything other than the greatest things about the Philadelphia Orchestra, but there are other great orchestras. Curtis is unique.
Can you, having gone through the school as a student, as a teacher, and now in a situation where you have a broader overview of what Curtis is about, could you maybe describe for us what you feel Mr. Grafman's legacy is or what his influence has been on the school over his tenure?
Should I leave the room now?
Please, so I don't embarrass you. I think that, you know, when you walk in the door, you feel immediately what his influence on this place has been, and I think you just need to look around and see the morale of the place, how happy the students are, and how dedicated they are to their work. I mean, it's interesting that they're just so successful, and that really comes from the top. And I think the fact that we have the success rate that we do as far as students that graduate from Curtis pursuing careers in music, it is that kind of caretaking that has been going on here at the school for the last 20 years that makes it the success it is.
Final question for both of you, and I'll ask you first, Roberto. We talked before we were recording about the fact that this spring you walk away from the Philadelphia Orchestra not to return in the fall. What are you going to miss about being an orchestra musician?
Fighting with my colleagues? No. I'm going to miss my colleagues, actually. I mean, they're a really fine group of musicians, many of them superstars on their instruments. It was funny, last week the board of the orchestra had a very nice dinner for Elisa and myself, and I had to say a few words, and one of the things that just sort of came to me on the spur of the moment was how hard it was to leave and how much harder it would have been if it wasn't just going four blocks away. There's a lot to miss there, leaving that, and it's 20 years of orchestra playing that I've done, and you know, from the day I left Curtis, I've been in an orchestra.
And I guess a similar question for you, Gary. What are you going to miss about coming through the doors of the Curtis Institute of Music every morning?
I'm not leaving Curtis. I am going to continue to teach here. And instead of having three students, as I do this year, which has sort of been the average that I've had during these 20 years, I'll have about twice as many. And that will be about the maximum amount of teaching that I will want to do. I'll play more. But I'll be here all the time because I'll be teaching here. I'll be responsible for six young people, so I'm going to be seeing them a lot.
But responsible for six rather than responsible for 130 or 140.
That's true. Yeah, but I think it's being put into very good hands, and I'll be around to, if I want to make a suggestion, even without being asked, I may. Who knows? No, but seriously, yes, of course I will miss certain aspects of it. On the other hand, some of the administrative stuff, I'm delighted to put in somebody else's hand. Yeah.
Gary Grafman, who retires as president of the Curtis Institute of Music on May 31st, and Roberto Diaz, the incoming president. Tomorrow evening at 8 at the Kimmel Center, Christoph Eschenbach conducts the Curtis Symphony in the first of many events paying tribute to Gary Grafman.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
If you happen to study some theater in college in recent decades, there's a good chance you were required to read a Carol Churchill play, or you may never have heard of her. While the playwright is well known in academic settings and her home country, England, she's not exactly a household name in the United States. But Churchill has been crafting drama since the early 1980s, and her formidable body of work is commonly cited as a significant influence on many modern playwrights. This week, the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia kicks off a Carol Churchill Festival. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the Churchill celebration provides Philadelphia audiences with an opportunity to take in the full range of the playwright's work.
This year marks the 25th anniversary of the critically acclaimed U.S. premiere of Cloud Nine, one of Carol Churchill's most famous and earliest works. Partly in commemoration of the anniversary, the Wilma Theatre begins their Carol Churchill Festival with Cloud Nine. The same year that Cloud Nine premiered in the United States, Blanca Ziska became co-artistic director of the Wilma Theatre. When Ziska looks back over her 25 years as artistic director at the Wilma, she has one regret involving Carol Churchill.
I am ashamed to say that Wilma Theatre has done none of her plays in the past, even though she is a writer who, you know, when you look at our mission, we should have done by now at least 3-4 of her plays, and we haven't for some reason, and I don't know quite why.
Carol Churchill is known for writing a diverse array of inventive, provocative, and complex plays. It's difficult to pin a particular style and subject matter on Churchill because she's written about so many different things in a variety of ways, from science to feminism to politics to the stock market. Blanca Ziska notes that few of Churchill's plays are very familiar to local theater audiences.
Her plays are mainly done in off-Broadway theaters, and most of the Philadelphia audience, when they do go to New York, they go to see Broadway productions, and so they miss her.
Now available to Philadelphia audiences, Cloud Nine is a story that explores issues of sexuality, social class, and gender roles. The first act is set in a British colony in Africa during the late 1800s. As reflected in the opening scene, a rigid, male-dominated, and racist Victorian culture is depicted and examined within the household of Clive, played by actor James Gale.
This is my family. Though far from home, we serve the Queen wherever we may roam. I am a father to the natives here, and a father to my family so dear.
The second act of Cloud Nine takes place 100 years later in an entirely different environment, 1970s London. Magically, the characters from Act One, who have only aged by 25 years, are transplanted into the world of Act Two. Here, themes of sexuality, gender, and race continue to be explored. Only now, it's in the context of a presumably more egalitarian and sexually free society. The Wilma's literary manager and dramaturge, Walter Bilderback, explains innovative storytelling techniques like these are a hallmark of Carol Churchill's work.
She sort of introduced magic realism, in a way, into the English and American theater, that you'll have something that is very realistic, and then all of a sudden there'll be a ghost. You'll have something very realistic, then they would just stop and break into a song. The same character will be played by different actors at different times, not just the normal doubling of one actor playing several different characters.
This actor's switching roles scenario is used in Cloud Nine. For instance, Craig Schwartz acts the role of a woman, Betty, in Act 1, and is a man, Edward, in Act 2. Conversely, Amy Fitz plays 9-year-old Edward in Act 1 and is Betty in Act 2. Amy Fitz says the demands of swapping roles with Craig Schwartz is made easier by virtue of having worked with him in other shows, but it's still complicated.
It's not just like your own creation of a character. You're taking bits from what each other has done and trying to make a through line into the second act of the play.
Fitz says that because the styles of each act are so vastly different, it almost feels like two plays within one. Director Blanca Ziska agrees. She notes that the production calls for almost two entirely different set designs. But Cloud Nine is only one part of the Carol Churchill Festival at the Wilma. A few weeks after Cloud Nine opens, the theater will mount Churchill's most recent work, A Number. The 2002 play deals with issues of human cloning. Ziska points out that as A Number and Cloud Nine run in repertory, the theater is essentially juggling three set designs.
We didn't try to create a design that would be embracing all the productions. We were trying to create a design that would be very specific for each of the production and then try to make it work. So the designs are very different, and I think people who will come and see will be quite surprised what the space is going to do.
Throughout the runs of Cloud Nine and A Number, the Wilma is also presenting readings of five other Churchill plays: Traps, Light Shining in Buckinghamshire, Top Girls, Fen, and Far Away. Dramaturge Walter Bilderback oversees these staged readings.
Unfortunately, we couldn't represent all of the variety of her work, even with these seven pieces. But it does give an opportunity to see her playing with a number of styles, to follow her work over 30 years.
Presented on Monday evenings during the festival, the readings will use local professional actors and directors. Each of the productions, without scenery or actor movement, will be given at least a day or two of rehearsal. Blanca Ziska says that the combination of these readings, two full productions and repertory, and even a symposium on bioethics, make the Carol Churchill Festival probably the most ambitious project the Wilma has ever undertaken.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Wilma Theatre's Carol Churchill Festival opens with Cloud 9 this Wednesday. A Number opens May 12th, and the festival runs through June 4th. The Kimmel Center has added 5 new works to its permanent collection of art created under the city's public art program. WRTI's Susan Lewis explores this and another Percent for Art program that helped make the streets of Philadelphia among the most art-rich in the nation.
Whether or not you're a person who likes to wander around art museums, if you live, work, or play in Philadelphia, you experience a museum of sorts every day as you walk past, around, under, and through works of art that change the landscape. Classical forms like sculptures at Swan Memorial Fountain in Logan Square. More contemporary art like the clothespin across from City Hall. Work reflecting pop culture themes like the statue of Rocky Balboa outside the sports stadiums. Even the stained glass bus stop shelters along Chestnut Street. This abundance of public art is no accident. In its early days, Philadelphia's position as the birthplace and first capital of the nation commanded impressive architecture with ornamental detail and rich statuary. And City Hall, completed in 1901, is proof of the city's love of sculpture. Yet, as America grew into the 20th century, construction in urban areas became utilitarian as other priorities took over the public realm. But in 1959, civic leaders took bold action. 2 separate programs tied the creation of art to the construction of new buildings. Michael von Marschsisker, chairman of the board of the Redevelopment Authority, came up with the idea to require that a redeveloper devote a minimum of 1% of his budget to a work of fine art in exchange for the rights to build on city property. Injecting art into this kind of business deal was innovative, and Susan Davis, director of the Redevelopment Authority's Fine Arts Program, says that it reflected the chairman's belief that art could enrich the lives of everyone in the community, not just those accustomed to museums.
He had the idea that art should be available to all people and should be something that people will find just as they're walking along the street. So it was put into all the agreements as a way of giving back to the city.
Later that same year, the city passed one of the nation's first Percent for Art ordinances, requiring that up to 1% of the total dollar amount for any construction contract for a building paid for wholly or in part by the city shall be devoted to fine arts. Carol Lawrence, a former deputy city representative for arts and culture, and now a VP for community development for PNC Bank, says that the process of choosing art would include the artistic community.
The thinking at that time was including artists in the process of choosing artwork that would enhance the city. By creating a Percent for Art program, a percentage would be given back to the citizens so that they can enjoy in future generations a collection.
The city's Office for Arts and Culture was abolished in 2003, but the Percent for Art ordinance is still on the books, and Stephanie Nadoff, the city's director of commerce, says she believes that it is an important part of Philadelphia.
It's a recognition that in addition to building great buildings, we need to affect the quality of life in Philadelphia by including art in the plans.
Of course, having an ordinance on the city books or a program in the Redevelopment Authority isn't the same thing as making it happen. As construction costs escalate, Nadoff acknowledges that sometimes developers balk.
Sometimes developers are reluctant, but I think the success of the program and the fact that people just love the art that has been installed throughout our city, and I think as the popularity of the program grows, the resistance goes down. The people are much more familiar with it and understand the value that it brings to our community.
The Percent for Art programs clearly differ in the details and in the actual dollar amounts spent on art. In practice, the Redevelopment Authority's 1% for Art is just that, a requirement that 1% of the entire building contract be spent on art. While the city ordinance refers to up to 1% of the total amount of any construction contract, in practice, this has been interpreted to require only 1% of the city's contribution. There's no minimum, and the exact number is negotiated, so the actual amount spent on art in city-funded projects can be significantly lower than 1% of the total construction costs. Yet both programs produce artwork that enhances the city's public spaces. Whether it's sculpture of fish glistening in the sun along the river at Penn's Landing, a redevelopment project, or a sculpture about the government of the people on the Municipal Services Plaza, a city project. Although much of the public art is sculpture, designed to weather the elements, public art can be in any media that will hold up in the space for which it's intended. An artist creating outdoor public art approaches the work in a different way, says Susan Davis of the Redevelopment Authority.
It's not a gallery artist who all of a sudden decides they want to do something outside. It's a very different form of making art.
Whether the display is indoor or out, Stephanie Nadoff agrees that the art must relate to the space it will occupy.
Each public art installation is different, is unique, is custom tailored to the site for which it is being included. And in each development, the process of selecting the art is different. It's tailor-made to that particular development.
The most recent public art installed under the city's program is inside the Kimmel Center. The five pieces include paintings by Mo Brooker, Elizabeth Osborne, and Sidney Goodman, a mosaic of billboard flickers by Stuart Netsky, and a wall-mounted sculpture by Fritz Dietl. All were chosen by a panel of jurists, including an artist, curator, collector, and others, and all relate to the space in the Kimmel Center. For example, Fritz Dietl's wooden sculpture Twist was inspired by an experience with music.
I was here in Philadelphia listening to a classical performance. I drew on the back of the program more or less this piece, and then I went back to the studio in subsequent months and created Twist. It's sort of a trumpet or cornucopia form. What's nice about it being a wall piece is that you can look back into it. You can get up on the third level and look inside and see that sort of opening, which is a nice element.
And so the bond between buildings and art continues. Both Percent for Art programs have new works in progress. The city looks forward to an installation in the new DE terminal at the airport, although the final selection may be several years away. And as technology changes, so do the possibilities for public art, as shown in a new redevelopment project involving a 24-foot square video projection at a blank wall at 11th and Arch, as Susan Davis describes.
It's called Shadows, and it's shadows of trees in different parts of Philadelphia in different seasons. So it's a continuous loop of tree shadows moving in the breeze, but the breeze won't be there. It'll all be imaginary.
In addition to the Percent for Art programs, the Fairmount Park Art Association, formed in 1872, continues to promote art in the rambling expanse of the city's over 9,000 acres of parkland, and the Mural Arts Program has made Philadelphia the mural capital of the country. So the next time you walk along the city streets, take in the view. It's likely that some great work of art is right in front of you, or just around the corner.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And just as the 1950s spawned a desire to ensure that urban development promoted art, rural development inspired others to preserve the past. Now in our regular dip into the Culture File section at gophilla.com, we take a trip to historic Falsington. It was a time of big-finned cars, TV dinners, and the baby boom, the 1950s in America. The breeding ground for much of this was the new American suburb. The suburbs changed not just the families and the fads, but also the landscape of the country, starting with two Levittowns, the first in Long Island, New York, and after its success, another in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The shrewd developer of these two planned communities, William Levitt, is often credited with being the creator of the American suburb. For many people, the idea of rows of nearly identical compact homes represented the American dream. For others, it was a nightmare.
And the small village atmosphere of Falsington was being threatened by all this new housing and building development, new roads, new schools. The infrastructure was totally changing all around it.
The story sounds like the beginning of a fairy tale, as Erica Armour, executive director of Historic Falsington, tells it. The people in the peaceful village living in their small hand-built houses until one day their happy existence was threatened by an ominous intruder. The scariest part about this story is the way it multiplied. In 1952, after plans for a new U.S. steel mill in the area were announced, the construction of Levittown, Pennsylvania began, and in the next 6 years over 17,000 houses were built. With each requiring a down payment of just $100, the houses were occupied immediately. Just 3 miles away, the village of Falsington had a slower growth. First settled by English Quaker farmers in the 1600s, the town was a picturesque example of colonial America. William Penn's country estate, Pensbury Manor, was down the road, and Penn himself often worshipped in a Quaker meeting house in Falsington. Change in the village was gradual. One Quaker meeting house gave route to two more, all three still at the same intersection today. It was what was happening to the area surrounding Falsington that alarmed residents of this quiet village, some of whom could trace their roots back to the first settlers. Concerns mounted when a 19th century stone house went up for sale, as Erica Armour explains.
There was folklore and stories running wild that this building would be purchased and torn down to provide space for a gas station, which is a classic Bucks County story.
As Armour is quick to admit, the bucolic farms had already become a thing of the past.
Now we grow houses, opposed to being once dairy farmers, wheat farmers, and truck farming. We now grow houses in Bucks, Montgomery, and Chester.
To make sure they didn't become part of this story, the residents of Falsington bought this house and created a non-profit organization with a mission to preserve the town and use it as a teaching tool for future generations. Since this first purchase, Historical Falsington Incorporated has purchased two more buildings and is now named on the National Registry of Historic Places, protecting it from future development. The Burgess Lippincott Mansion, as the first house purchased is called, demonstrates, among other things, how our ideas about house sizes have changed in 200 years. The Federal-style stone building is about the same size as a modest home in Levittown. The house is open for tours and is set up for 19th-century living. Falsington, with its narrow streets and modest houses, feels like a rural village, although big-box shopping malls loom just minutes away. Erica Armour points to what looks like a large log cabin.
We're right now at the Moon Williamson Log House, which is still standing on its original site and was built in the 1760s. We interpret colonial life through this. We talk about how the settlers came into the area, the hardships they faced, the primitive lifestyles. We can go inside right now.
After a tour of the cold and dark and, all things considered, rather cute house, visitors can wander around the village where there are over 90 historic homes. Peeking in these windows, however, is not appreciated. Unlike other historic sites, there are real people living in these houses in this still active town. Visitors can stop in the Stagecoach Tavern, built in 1790. The preserved tavern is a reminder that public houses were once there for more than just a cold pint, as Erica Armour explains.
Out here in the country, a tavern is more of an inn. It's very interchangeable at that point in time. Because we are farmers in this area, we need a place to rest, water our livestock, maybe get wagon wheels repaired, get something to eat ourselves, back and forth between Morrisville, Trenton, and Philadelphia. So a tavern makes sense for the community. In a tavern like this, the tavern keeper would have served homemade beer or hard cider, which was very prevalent during that time. Water was always suspect. So hard cider was a beverage of choice. Children drank hard cider. It was not unusual. A smart tavern keeper would actually have newspapers dropped off, and he would act as the local postmaster, which indeed this tavern keeper did. So people would come here on a daily basis to pick up their letters, their news, their correspondence, and then exchange news.
With the dining area set up for tea and the yellowed newspapers on the coffee table, it almost feels as if William Penn himself will walk through the door with the news of the day. And the sounds of modern life notwithstanding, if William Penn did show up, he'd probably still feel rather comfortable here. More information on Historic Falsington is available at the Culture Files section of gofilla.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Jennifer Reisers, Megan Wendell, Paul Murata, and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.